It must be Friday again because I'm doing the post-game show. So welcome to the TYT post-game show. Malcolm, Steve, my usual buddies are out. But we have Dan Evans Nakamura in house for the summer. And Dan, thanks for joining me here again.
Hello.
You've been on with me, I don't know, it was like many months ago to talk about what was going on at Berkeley, because you happened to be in LA soon after the whole Milo thing. Is that when we spoke?
So we spoke about it during the telethon where I was predicting that Milo Yiannopoulos coming to speak at UC Berkeley, where I'm going to be a senior there next year, that he was going to speak at campus. He's a very inflammatory speaker, and that there are going to be large protests.
And sure enough.
While you kind of said that like it wasn't really much of a debate to have, that of course you're going to let him speak. Then our student union caught on fire because of the protest of Milo Yiannopoulos speaking. So that happened, and that led to another chain of events.
So that was midway through the school year, approximately.
February,
and Dan is going to fill us in on what happened at Berkeley subsequent to that and catch us all up. That'll be at the end, appropriately with that. So today's show is not full of obituaries like last week. I only have one, and it's a Berkeley professor, so we'll bring that in a little later. Law school professor, so you probably wouldn't know anything about her.
Law school professor is hit or miss. We have a big like sexual assault scandal there.
Okay, well, we'll get to that. I do want to say I wasn't that happy with my last week's not wall-to-wall obituary segment, but the comments from you guys were pretty positive and favorable, so thank you. I'm glad that some of you enjoyed it. One guy went too far. He said he's looking forward to retiring. And then he just envisions himself sitting on his back porch or something like that, reading obituaries all day. That's a little grim for retirement. Plus, I don't think that many interesting people die every day. But I'm glad that I was able to inspire you. And I thank you for watching.
Inspire people through the gospel of death.
Right. In the background here today, we're celebrating here, or at least one person in the studio is Bart.
Shout out to Bart.
60th anniversary of John Lennon meeting Paul McCartney at St. Peter's Church in Liverpool. John Lennon was playing there. Paul McCartney was in attendance to listen. They liked each other's playing. And they met 60 years ago today in Liverpool in that St. Peter's Church. Now, we're not going to talk about the Beatles in this segment, but I did want to, Bart asked us to promote that or mention that because it is the anniversary. So good. It's interesting. It's a cute little old brick church. I'm surprised it's still standing. If I ever go to Liverpool, I'll probably seek it out.
David, that should be sacred ground.
Not everything in England's like, everything England's been around for a while. So of course it's going to be still standing.
Dave, that should be sacred ground.
It should be.
It is, and it should be.
You know, I envision Liverpool as a post-industrial declining city where it's everything crumbling, no one working. And that might be partially true. I don't know if it was true in 1942 or whenever that was.
Well, he didn't read it in the obituary, so it must still be going.
Yeah. Right. Well, okay, so let's just jump into the story. First story is an article in the New York Times from a couple of days ago or earlier this week about a wave of immigration arrests and deportations of Iraqi Christians, they're technically known as Chaldean, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, Chaldean Christians, who are living in the Detroit suburbs area in Michigan. This is a block of, so they're Iraqi Christians, they're not Muslims, they're not Arabs. Their families, in most cases, left Iraq back in 1979 and after Saddam Hussein took power. And they've been living in the United States, in some cases, for all these decades. And this block in particular supported Donald Trump pretty strongly in the election. And as you recall, Michigan was a crucial state and a surprise victory that helped launch Trump to the White House. And this group of Christians in the Detroit suburbs, Iraqi Christians, supported Trump. And they all, in general, they believed, even though he talked about banning immigrants, he talked about banning Muslims, not people necessarily from Iraq. So they thought, well, that's great. This will never happen to us. He's not going to kick us out. We're Christians. And Trump spoke about supporting Middle Eastern Christians during the campaign and Iraqi Christians. Well, now.
And once elected, talked about it.
Yeah. Well, now look what happens. The DHS or whoever's conducting the raids, the
immigration. Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement is going after these Iraqi Christians who have some sort of criminal record, who have or there's some reason to be deported, and they're deporting them. So there's about half a dozen sub stories that I want to get into. It. Let's start with the first one that I already mentioned, the surface one. People who voted for Trump saying, yeah, you're going to ban those Muslims, but you're not going to come after us, of course. So that's great. And now look what's happened.
Of course.
So what do you have to say to people who think, oh yeah, he's going to be a bigot toward the other races and ethnicities, but we're going to be okay under this guy?
Yeah, it's a pattern that I've been noticing that I've like written about a little recently about how I think that Donald Trump as a whole has kind of won the war against sympathy in the United States, to where in order for people to understand the gravity of certain political situations now, you have to make it relate to that person in particular.
It's kind of like you.
It's like what we saw with like marriage equality and how Republicans weren't coming out in support of marriage equality until they found out that like a gay son or like a trans niece or something like mm-hmm. that until it directly affected them. And like it's great that they can at least walk a mile in their shoes, but you want people to have to do that before they're in that situation, like vote a little more smartly.
Yeah, and to people who can think beyond themselves and project to others and kind of step in other people's shoes, it's very frustrating when others can't do that.
Yes.
But it's a reality of society and especially of politics. You gotta make it personal for people, otherwise they're just gonna think about themselves.
Yeah.
And they're gonna think, what he's doing to others doesn't apply to me. It's true throughout the history, of course, most famously.
Well, with Christianity, it's do unto others as you would want done to you. So why can't they apply their Christianity to their vote? I don't know.
So by the way, in case you missed it, the problem is they're deporting these Iraqi Christians back to Iraq where they face persecution and retribution and violence because they're not wanted there. Christians in Iraq, I forget the numbers, but when a few decades ago it was about 2 million Christians, and now they're down to a few tens of thousands because they're severely persecuted in Iraq.
Yeah.
If not by the government, just by the population.
Yeah, there's one quote in there where someone said that the Iraqi Christians that would be deported wouldn't make it off of the airport
right
before they were persecuted.
In many cases, they tattooed themselves with crosses and Christian symbolism. So it's a real problem for them. But let's talk about that. Is it a real problem? So some who are being deported because they're here without permission, or they came without permission, and they committed crimes, and they're supposed to be deported, but no one ever got around to finding them until now. And then you realize, well, you ask yourself, well, maybe they should be deported. I mean, what are the rules? What do we want? What does a good, liberal, open-minded, enlightened person, progressive, who wants to protect everyone, what are we supposed to do? Do you have an answer?
Well, I don't know. I love to call like whenever you're on the post game, like the nuance show, because you have these like nuanced views to it,
right,
even though you play totally true, totally bullshit. But like, to me, when you look at why these people are getting like deported, some of them have like murder convictions, according to the article.
Or violent crimes of various sorts.
Yeah, and then some of them have convictions like drug possession. One of them broke into a car when they were a teenager. I mean, these are things that do violate the terms of their green cards, right? So by the letter of the law, they committed some sort of felony, so they should have been deported. The reason why they weren't deported earlier is that up until recently, Iraq wasn't honoring the deportation, so they wouldn't even take them back.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, just over the laws and morals things, I think that some of the things that liberals or like progressives love to say people shouldn't be persecuted harshly for, like the drug possession thing. I don't see deporting someone over drug possession, and I'm more of a fan of restorative justice practices. So you teach someone maybe why drugs are dangerous to that some extent, not where marijuana. I believe this was like a harder drug possession, but mm-hmm. Those restorative justice policies would be better. For the harder crimes like rape, murder, things like that, of course, you treat those as you should, and you should, since they violated the terms of their green cards, I would say deport them.
Yeah, now we're not saying you go in, grab them, arrest them, send them out of the country. There's a process.
Exactly.
Maybe the process already occurred, or maybe it has to occur. As long as there's a due process, a review of the case, and they can present their case in front of a judge, et cetera. If the result is they violated the terms, especially with a violent crime, then okay, yeah, I think you got to be deported. I mean, that's...
Yeah. I mean, the fights we're having for immigration are for the people who, like, not just, I don't want to idolize the people who like, oh, you worked your way and you got into a great college and all that stuff, because not everyone's going to be that like fantastic. But if you came to the United States because your country has been ravaged by the United States' drug war, mm-hmm. and you're coming to just like make a decent living and maybe you get pulled over for a parking ticket or something, not too like, nothing too crazy, then yeah, I believe there should be a way for you to kind of conduct your life and live your life to the best way possible when you're contributing to society in your job, in the taxes that you're paying, all of those things. But when it comes down to criminal cases, that's when you have to strike down a little more and say, is your like ability or freedom to be in the United States as a non-citizen, well, that comes with certain terms. And if you break one, if you break a law, especially a severe one like any of these criminal cases, then yeah, sorry, you broke the terms, you'll have to be deported. But right. Then you get into what are these criminal cases, things like drug possession, which I don't agree with personally, but.
Okay, so that gets to the next level. If you're talking about the philosophy of criminal justice, let's say someone 25 years ago committed a violent crime, never got caught or punished for it, and then lived as an absolute model citizen ever since.
Finally, did their time in
justice
jail.
Get, well, I said no time in jail.
Okay.
No, they just got clean away with it. Let's say not a violent crime, but I don't know, some, maybe at least a felony.
Let's say they robbed a liquor store.
Sure, with a gun.
Right.
But didn't hurt anyone. And then he lived as a model citizen for the next 25 years. And then finally, the authorities catch the person. I bet a lot of people, maybe even us, would have sympathy. Say like, okay, yes, he should have been arrested. He should have gone to jail. But the purpose of putting someone in jail, there's two purposes. One is to take them out of society. And another is to restore them, if that's the right word that we use.
Not in the American justice system. Right.
So in 25 years, this person has proven not to commit more, not to repeat. He's not a repeat offender. He has not committed crimes. And he appears to have repented or whatever the word for right. his crime. So I bet a lot of people would have sympathy for not deporting these people and letting them be. But then let's say you catch someone who committed the liquor store robbery yesterday. No one's going to say, oh, let's give him 25 years and see if it works out for everybody. You want to throw him in jail right away.
I think the difference between that is just like, well, I mean, the large obvious difference is one happened 25 years ago and one happened recently. The one that happened 25 years ago is like a bureaucratic error where if you follow the letter of the law that clearly, then they were on a work visa or a green card of some kind. They broke a law. They committed a felony. You send them away. Or you like, if you can't send them away in like the Iraq situation, you like put them in jail for their felony. But because of that bureaucratic failure and that didn't happen immediately, mm-hmm. and they were able to have that 25 years where they made themselves to be like a model reformed citizen or whatever right. you want to call it, then that's easier to rule on. And the law might not protect you, but maybe we want to create a law that's some sort of like amnesty in situations like that and other situations where like people have proven themselves to be more model. But I mean, in the other case, that's a lot more open and shut, especially in a Trump era where we're going to be harder on deportations like that.
Well, I don't know how open and shut it is in the Scandinavian model or what. Not that I know the details of Scandinavian criminal justice system, but there are ways of doing criminal justice that are more lenient than, oh, you robbed the liquor store with a gun, go to jail.
Oh yeah, well, I'm speaking purely in like the American justice system, which mm-hmm. I have like a bit of cynicism for. But like philosophically speaking, then you could, there are like restorative justice programs that I think some Scandinavian, some like Northern European countries kind of have, where they try to like help you get back on your feet or help you learn the morals why like what you did was a wrong thing. And then hopefully send you out society with like the education, maybe some
right, job
like
training,
other tools
maybe.
To right. kind of get back on your feet and make sure you're a model citizen. Yeah. That would be a great thing to do. It's just that in America, we spend all of our money on private prisons.
So, but my point is there's a lot of layers to this deportation story, and we're not done. So now I just have a snide comment.
Three
One of the examples
deep.
In the New York Times article was a guy who was, again, Iraqi Christian, came to the U.S., I guess not properly. And at some point in a road rage incident, he flashed a gun in front of the other driver, I suppose, and was never brought to justice for that or arrested or anything. But it's a violation of his terms. And finally, years later, maybe decades later, they found this guy. Now they want to deport him. Now, I'm not going to repeat the discussion we just had, but I thought Trump and the Republicans are big Second Amendment rights advocates. Is it
deportable offense to flash a gun, even if you don't use it? Come on, these guys are supposed to protect gun rights, right? They're full of shit is the reason.
Yeah, I mean, this
plus there's a big disconnect.
This is the pure unadulterated post game, which so I can say that when you're saying that they're the Second Amendment rights people and they're protecting their guns, the NRA has proven that they're clearly fucking liars and they're only protecting the right for white people to own guns. Because in the Philando Castile case, when you had someone who legally had a gun and did everything you were supposed to do and was still shot by police, the NRA is silent because they were too busy making a video scaremongering about like people in Berkeley protesting and about racism and sexism and said you need to take up arms against them.
Yeah.
And so it's clear that the NRA is not a gun rights organization. They're a arm of the conservative part of America that also handles guns, which makes anything they do that much more threatening. Not because it's tied to conservative ideology, but because they're saying you use your conservative ideology and your like love for guns to look at your political opponents and say they are a threat to that. Not to get too into the NRA.
But you did. But I can't say I disagree with you. Although what makes this case more interesting is it's not a pure black and white case. This is an Iraqi Christian. He's a Christian and the conservatives are supposed to protect Christians. But he's Iraqi,
again,
Middle Easterner, so he's not a white guy. Yeah, so they're full of shit, right. Then finally, there's another person. I don't know, I have a lot of respect for this person. Voted for Trump. And then either, I forget the details, either she or her husband or her his wife is being deported for these reasons that we're talking about. And then this person says, well, no, I don't really blame Trump. These details like this probably don't even make it to his desk. A, she or he is probably right. I don't know if Trump knows or if any president knows that the ICE is now conducting raids in the Detroit suburb. Maybe they do. But she's probably right that it didn't cross Trump's desk. So then that almost negates this whole conversation that we're having. And what is the president? Who's authorizing this? Where's it coming from?
I would disagree to an extent because I think we've been so accustomed in the past like couple months of lowest common denominator presidenting that we forgot that, yeah, maybe Obama didn't have his like finger on the pulse of what was happening in the corner office of the EPA, right? But like, these are all executive orders. These are happening from the executive branch.
From the executive branch, sure.
And so that means that there's someone who deals with ICE who answers to the president. And this executive order likely was not drafted by Trump, if we'll be real, but it was drafted by his advisors. You'd think that his advisors would like, okay, in a normal presidency, when you have advisors who are working on things for you, they will fill you in on the details because it's going to be something that you're going to have to defend, right? So maybe because this gets a little wonky about how the reason Iraq got off of the travel ban list was because of a deal made between the US and Iraq so that Iraq would start accepting deportees
right,
again.
Like these guys.
So this can happen again in return for getting off the travel ban list.
Right.
That's a really wonky detail that I don't expect Trump to really be involved in, although that's the reason why it was even able to get this far, because that's how you got rid of because this clause doesn't protect Christians anymore. Now the left has a harder time calling it a Muslim ban.
Right.
Because the original version was like, we'll make these exemptions for Christians. And that's what Trump tweeted out about. And that's what I think a lot of people in this community
supporters
like
it.
Had.
Right.
That's what they thought the promise was broken.
Yeah, right. Okay, good point. Thank you. All right, so that's all the layers that I had on that story. Luckily, the next couple of stories before we get to Berkeley are much faster.
Can I make one more point about this?
Yes, please do.
I mean, if all the people on the right are saying that Islam is this religion where you have all these like terrible things that are happening and you're bringing over criminals. And maybe not even Islam as a religion as a whole is dangerous, but hey, right now at this time, most of the terrorism is happening in the name of Islam. Maybe you could make that argument. I don't, but okay. In this case, these are Iraqi Christians who are committing, who have committed crimes in this country. Do we want to deport all the Iraqis? Do we want to deport all the Christians? No, like, crime and extremism are part of humanity, and people take whatever they can to make themselves feel like they're right. In the Western world, we have echo chambers where we look towards our corner of the internet, our corner of the world, to justify that we're right. Other people, including in the Western world, but in other places, the way you justify your right is through your religion. And so that's the argument that people are making, not that, oh, the left is soft on Islam when we need to be tough on Islam, like people on Bill Maher will argue. It's just like, no, this is just human behavior, and there are people who are using religion to justify their crazy shit. But in order to to ban people based on a religion or based off of a place they're from just makes no sense. And I think that the biggest part of the story is that yeah. that's just a case study. Yeah, okay, I'm done off my soapbox.
No, that's a good elucidating point. Yes, thank you. Yeah. I don't have any comments because I got to think about that. That's another characteristic. I don't just go right off the cuff, but all right. So now we'll move on. So earlier this week, the Federal Circuit Court in Washington, D.C. blocked the EPA and Scott Pruitt's attempt to block an Obama-era methane rule that sought to reduce methane emissions from oil and gas fields. Obama placed a rule regulating how you have to handle, you know, methane releases and equipment that might have failed that to protect against methane releases. And the oil industry, of course, thought that was too burdensome. So their buddy, Scott Pruitt, now head of the EPA, sought to block it. At first, he put a 90-day moratorium on it. Then he put a two-year moratorium on it. And the federal D.C. Circuit Court overruled Scott Pruitt, or said the EPA does not have the authority to just block this rule. If you're going to do that, you're essentially reversing the rule. And if you're going to do that, you got to follow a goddamn procedure to do it. You can't just block it on your own whim. And in fact, they called the decision, Scott Pruitt's decision, capricious. So, I mean, that's, of course, a piece of good news. It's good that the system is still working. There's still courts there's checks and balances. Interestingly, and I don't know the details of how the judicial system is set up and the court system, and if any members do, please write in the comments below. So the DC Circuit, which is a very important circuit court because all the government cases go there, has whatever, a dozen judges on it. I don't know the exact number. Majority of them, I think, were nominated by Republican presidents, including many from Reagan still. But this was a panel of three. I don't know why, you know, cases sometimes are the full court, or if they're ever the full court or just a panel. If you know any of this, you can jump in. But this was a panel of three judges out of a dozen. Turns out two of them were not, in this case, were nominated by Democrats, one by Obama, one by Clinton. And the third judge is Janice Rogers Brown, who was a big controversial appointment to this circuit by George W. Bush. And she's a name thrown out there. Well, all these names are thrown out there for potential Supreme Court nominations one day.
Do you know why the George W. Bush pick was controversial?
Well, because the Democrats thought that she was too conservative.
Okay.
So that's not all. Just politics.
Not ordinarily, not out of the ordinary controversial. Like, oh, she had ties to big oil or something.
I don't remember the details, but you know, now it's a routine for the Democrats and the Republicans to block as much as possible the picks of the other president, more so the Republicans, of course, than the Democrats. Maybe she's got ties to some big industry that they think corrupts her. It's possible. I just don't remember the
details. Yeah, I don't know for sure. I'm just guessing based off of patterns.
It was one of the big judicial fights during the George W. Bush administration, Janice Rogers Brown's nomination. But she eventually got through. And she was in the minority on the 2-1 decision on this to stop the EPA from blocking a methane rule. And I'm just glad that the thing worked. I'm glad there are enough Clinton and Obama judges, even though the Republicans did everything they could to stop them. I'm glad there are enough out there that they can still defend the interests of the people rather than the interests of the oil companies in cases like this one. And if anyone can explain how that DC Circuit Court works, why this panel of these three judges ruled on this case and not some other panel where it might have been two Republicans to one Democrat and the ruling would have been the opposite, I'd like to know. Maybe Merrick Garland is the Chief Justice of this appeals court, of this circuit court. So maybe he assigns which judges will hear each case and then he's putting his finger on the lever there.
Who? How many judges decide on this case? Three?
And this panel of three.
I can't believe three is quorum. Like, that's, you only need three judges for these cases. But
yeah,
okay.
Well, all right.
That's rules. I guess on that, I'm still surprised that people still say Trump drained the swamp when, like, the former head of ExxonMobil is now the Secretary of State. And yeah, you have someone like Scott Pruitt as the head of the EPA. That's like an ultimate slap in the face, the idea of draining the swamp. But people are going to say that this is a response. Like, anytime, what's been going on in the right is that anytime there's a case where the government goes against Trump, they call that, the deep state strikes again. This idea that there's some dark secret forces that are like unelected, that almost like Illuminati level shit, where no matter how much Donald Trump, this like crazy rebel who's gonna shake up the system, tries, like the deep state will somehow prevent him.
Right.
All the deep state is are people who like punch in the clock every day, who like have been doing their same job, and things change slightly depending on what president's in power, but more or less you're just doing the same job for your career, right? That's not the deep state, it's just saying, hey, we're still one arm of the government where politics works kind of as usual. And so we're gonna continue making politics work kind of as usual. And like you said, that means that there are certain checks and balances that are still there.
Yeah, the deep state concept, Jenks has spoken about this recently on the show, is a lot less impactful in the United States than in other countries like Turkey, where it's huge.
Yeah.
So you're right, this is not the deep state.
Yeah, here the deep state is demonized as this big entity. I'm just telling people, like, it's just people who work rank and file jobs in government agencies. It's everyday people who like might have a house down the street from you. It's not these secret people in closed, like smoke-filled rooms and closed doors, as people try to say, like the Alex Jones of the world will try to say it is.
But the deep state is, to some degree, synonymous with the military-industrial complex, and that's real. And the military-industrial complex is also people who just live in the house down the street. But there's
a difference between like checks and balances acting as checks and balances, and military contractors trying to get like contracts for their more war and get contracts for their companies.
Right. Yeah. Right. Now we're going to move to the theme of again. So, two stories, again from the New York Times. Yeah, I criticize Cenk for where he gets his news from, but I'm flawed too, because I just go to the New York Times, and that's terrible too, that it's so limited. But it's working for me today. So, there's an article this week about how, as ISIS is being defeated in Iraq and Syria in terms of territory, they're ramping up their insurgent attacks, terrorist attacks, launching explosives into civilian areas, all suicide bombs, that kind of thing. In the recent months, there have been 1,500 approximately insurgent attacks by ISIS in areas that they've been pushed out of. And I'm reading the article saying, of course, who the hell was talking about defeating ISIS other than the idiot Trump and all the media? It's a terrorist group. For a couple of years, they actually had territory and a bureaucracy and everything. But you don't defeat ISIS, and even if you do, something will replace it, or they're going to morph into just a terrorist organization or return to being a terrorist organization. This article was all the most predictable thing in the world.
Yeah.
And if you actually do defeat ISIS, the terrorists will come out with a different name, just like it used to be Al-Qaeda.
Precisely.
And now ISIS is our number one enemy, and maybe 3 years it'll be some other terrorist group.
You don't, like, my two points to that are, A, the idea of we will defeat insert like Muslim sounding terrorist group here.
Or acronym.
Or acronym, depending on like some places use like Islamic State or ISIL or whatever. But like, that's only a political tactic. That only works in the realm of politics, because you realize if you just do like a tiny little bit of research into this stuff that like terrorism and extremism are based around, like I said earlier, just human ideas. And you can't kill an idea. The fact, all you do is just, when you try to kill an idea, oftentimes you just make more people sympathetic to that idea.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the way you're not gonna defeat terrorism is by sending more troops, sending more MOABs and things like that. What you're going to be doing is just giving, I mean, part of that's gonna be that, because there's some people who just like, you kind of have to get rid of, but you have to do that in a smart way. But the other way is just by changing our overwhelming foreign policy to make it so it's harder to scapegoat the West.
Right.
Because right now, all these terrorists are recruiting, saying, look at what kind of monster Trump is, or like, look what kind of monster even Obama was with the drone strikes, which have only like increased the number over Trump.
Right.
With Trump, I mean. If we change our foreign policy to where we're not droning weddings and other things like that indiscriminately, then people will have less of a reason to hate America.
Right.
And that will go a longer way towards defeating the idea and the battle of ideas that has to happen and that is happening in the Middle East. That'll go a longer way than just sending in more troops, because we've been sending in more troops for decades, double, triple my lifetime to the Middle East.
Right.
And we're in square one with better technology and different names.
And sadly, it's seems likely, maybe even in his first year in office, that Trump will one day come out and declare that we've defeated ISIS. Because they are on territorially.
With a flight suit on a little like aircraft carrier that says like ISIS accomplished.
Yes.
And then we'll laugh about the banner because that's stupid.
Because they are losing territory that they control on a semi-permanent basis. And as soon as all that's gone and the maps that they show on TV no longer have any ISIS territory, it's going to be a great moment for him. But it will mean absolutely nothing because of stories like this. They're still going to be out there doing insurgent attacks and killing civilians left and right. So, yeah.
As long as we continue these like generally hostile policies, then it's just going to continue.
So then the next story, the second and last one in the theme of again, is about the American auto industry. Sales of American-built cars have declined for the sixth month in a row. But it's not that simple. Trucks and SUVs are doing very well. It's small cars and very efficient cars that are really hurting sales because gas prices are low these days. How goddamn short-sighted is society? Of course that... Yes.
I was just going to say, Trump tweeted out recently that, oh, wow, the gas prices are low. Good thing Trump's in office, even though we blamed Obama for gas prices. And then we also said that, by the way, presidents don't influence gas prices.
Right. Oh, gas prices is the most amusing political football there is because all the different contradictory comments will be made depending on what the situation is.
It's what happens when you get politicians who don't have enough economists on their side and can't tell you that there's no difference.
Well, you can have as many economists as you want. I still don't know what the answer is. It's a really complex, it has a little to do with politics, a lot to do with the market.
Petrodollar, all of those things. But
so once again, America is building big SUVs and trucks and not building small cars because price prices are low. They will inevitably go up and they're going to go up quickly and very high. And then all these car industries, companies are going to say, oh no, we invested in the wrong thing and it's all going to collapse all over again. Now, I have some sympathy for them. I don't want a communist command and control economy where the government says, no, you must build small, fuel efficient cars.
I, for one, endorse that. I'm kidding.
Maybe.
I'm totally kidding, kind of.
But there is a benefits to the capitalism in the nice sense of the word where the companies react to the market. Place. The big problem here is that oil prices are not in any way a free market. It's totally propped up by US military force. So we have artificially low prices.
We have oil reserves as well. And like the release of those reserves can change the oil prices as well.
Right. And it's not just the military component, because now the US is producing a tremendous amount of oil and gas, and the OPEC is too, because they want to drive the prices down for geopolitical reasons.
Fracking.
Fracking's helping. People want to stick it to Russia, who's suffering greatly with the with the low oil prices. So, I don't know. I don't want the auto companies to be told to build fuel efficient cars, and they're not going to. If right now what's selling well is trucks and SUVs, then they're going to build trucks and SUVs. So I don't know really how to do this properly. All I do know is we're not doing it right now. And we're going to predict the newspaper article 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years from now about how all these auto companies are hurting big time because they built way too many SUVs and trucks and not enough fuel efficient cars.
I think and you happen to touch on like a fun subject because I just love cars, but I think auto companies, especially in America, are just very, very slow to adapt to like changing ideas and changing ways that the industry is going to work. Volvo just announced that by 2019, I believe, all of their cars will have an electric motor, which means they'll either be hybrids or electric only. So no longer going to make gas cars. Tesla, they're about to ship their first Model 3 this week. They're going to ramp up to more of those by 2018. Hopefully I can get that for my graduation. But it's going to be an relatively affordable electric car that people can have that has like range comparable to other cars. So you have these other energies that are coming into our cars, and Chevy's done a good job. GM's done a good job with their Volt and their Bolt, that those have done really well. But yeah, like you said, people have demand for big cars all of a sudden. I'm almost getting nostalgia from like 2005 and 2006 when at least like on my block, all the cookie cutter families were fighting to see who had the bigger SUV.
Right.
And so like some of the neighbors got the Escape and my dad was like, fuck that, you're getting an Explorer to my mom. And then someone down the street got an Expedition, and then someone got an Excursion, and that car is just long and weird, so that kind of ended there.
But maybe the companies that you mentioned, Volvo, Tesla, et cetera, some divisions of GM and Chevy, will be smarter and have a longer term outlook. And when the inevitable oil price spike comes, they'll be in good shape. And that's capitalism also.
That's what I was saying. Like, so Tesla is coming out. They already have the Model X SUV. Yeah. So the great thing about these companies that are getting ahead of what you're saying, the companies that know that oil is not sustainable, obviously, but the ones who are making business decisions based off of that, they're going to be ready for the people who go, well, I like the size of my Ford Expedition, but gas costs too much money. And they'll be like, well, wonderful, we have a Volvo right here that's hybrid, or we have a Volvo right here that's electric. And so they're going to be the ones that are ready, while the big like car companies will have trouble with capital investments and making sure they can transition faster.
Sure.
Yeah. So again, like I was joking earlier about the like communism thing, but this is capitalism working in a way that hopefully will be helpful for us, because this will create the demand to produce more electricity, which will hopefully create the demand to have more renewable energy supplies.
Yeah, but plus the auto companies are not just innocently building SUVs and trucks. They lobby the government to modify rules in that favor small trucks and SUVs, not just gas prices. But you know, there was big in the 90s when some regulation was issued that classified SUVs as, I forget the deal, as cars rather than trucks, which subjects them to a lower scrutiny, lower standards.
Lower miles per gallon standards.
Right. So they're corrupting the process with their lobbying. Okay, so those are the stories. And now we move on to Berkeley. So we talked about it at the beginning of the show. We last spoke right before Milo's appearance or scheduled appearance at Berkeley, when things blew up. So what happened with that real quick? And then there was continuing controversy coming out of Berkeley for the rest of that.
The plot continues to thicken. So as you said, like in late December, we were talking about this. I was worried that it would become some big protest thing. It did. Right. And there were 1,000 people, or like roughly 1,000 students, who were at our Martin Luther King Jr. Student Union, of course, Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And really the students were in back, kind of like watching the shit show happen. While the big deal was like the Milo supporters, who I would call them Proud Boys. That's what they call themselves. It's like a sect of the alt-right. And they were clashing with what we came to know as Antifa, the anti-fascists, who both of which, most of them weren't students. On either side weren't students. And these were outside agitators on the left, on the right, duking it out and making our campus the battlefield. Fires ensued, riot police ensued, someone was hit by a car. It was really crazy and like really bad. But no, Milo kind of used it to supercharge his career until we found out that he was making pedophilia jokes. Right.
So did he give a speech at Berkeley after that?
No.
It had to be canceled.
No, had to be canceled. There was video of like riot police all over the building, and like the Antifa people were shooting fireworks and things at them. They had burned a big like light post that was around there. So there was no way, even on a safe even a safe standard.
By the way, why can't the university administration close the campus to outsiders for a couple of?
There aren't gates.
There aren't gates?
No, you can walk onto the campus really easily.
All right. Okay, so that was when?
That was February 1st.
Right, and so what happened since?
So since then, there's a little timeline. On March 4th, there was the national March for Trump, but it didn't really do really well. It didn't make any headlines anywhere because like no one's actually marching for Trump, or like very few people are. But there was one of those in Berkeley, and it was about like, about a month after the Milo protests happened. I think the March for Trump in DC had 150 people showing up, which is almost so pitiful, I don't even want to report it, but okay. And then in Berkeley, 7 people were injured and 10 were arrested. And again, just brawls between the hard right who was there and Antifa, who also showed up. I now know, being a like Berkeley resident, that it's a bad day when the banks start boarding up their ATMs.
Yeah.
Because what they always do is they go for, like, once Antifa's done with their like alt-right clashes, they go into their own form of anarchy, which is just like smashing all the windows to the banks and the big stores and et cetera, et cetera. It's fun dealing with Antifa. But April 15th, that was a really big one where like on basically the main hub of downtown Berkeley. It was all shut off because there was a like pro-Trump rally that was planned there. So you had not just the Proud Boys, but you had, I think the group is called Identity Europa. And so you can kind of tell where they're coming from. They're definitely white nationalists. Mm-hmm. I saw people with shields and like swastikas and things, other alt-right.
You're like one of these people who seeks trouble?
I'm one of these people who's too curious for them. Okay. It's also pretty close to where I was. Right. So yeah, I was, and also fun as a like black man walking through those. It's a wonderful experience. Crossed walking through a field of white nationalists off my bucket list that day. But no, I like was able to talk to some of them. I talked to some of the Antifa people. I talked to some of the nicer alt-right people. Tried to stay out of politics, but just kind of like get their mood of how things were going there. And yeah, things were just like very tense. But they believe that they're marching for their freedoms and showing the fact they have a freedom to exist, I guess, because they see it as like the right sees it as they're being attacked on their existence, which is an interesting thing. But there are 500 to 1,000 people there. There was tear gas thrown out. The police had to intervene. It was really bad.
So it's downtown Berkeley. This has nothing to do with campus.
But Berkeley's a very dense city. Mm-hmm. And so the campus is about a 2-block walk from downtown.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. And so these are all like related things. A lot of people, like a lot of professors, like canceled classes that day just because to get to class, a lot of people would have to like walk directly into that. You don't want to have people walk in harm's way. That was the big like where the punch Nazis. Do you hear about the like whole punch Nazi debate happening? Well, there was, and Jenk and Anna talked about it on the show a little bit, where like there's this debate on the left whether it's more like morally ethical to punch a Nazi.
Oh, right. I didn't know about that.
Well, that sparked up again because there was a white nationalist who I think started Identity Europa from Cal State Stanislaw, a school I didn't even know existed. Yeah,
I think it's really new.
There goes my Berkeley elitism showing. But he was like a 30-year-old student from there, and he punched a woman in the face and then ran back into the crowd and was caught on video doing that as well. And so that sparked the punch Nazi ethical debate thing again. But the big story, I think, is on April 27th when Ann Coulter was supposed to come. Mm-hmm. And that's like, I had compared back then Milo to like a new age Ann Coulter. Well, this time you just got literal old age Ann Coulter coming.
Right.
And the same thing, not for any real logical reason or like for actual debate, just to like rile things up and see what she could do. Because Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos are all like right wing fame whores.
Yeah.
And they just—
provocateurs.
Yeah, and they use the kind of unbridled outrage from the left to prop themselves up, because the more the left attacks them, the more passionate the right gets about them. But yeah, that was not going to happen. The campus officials were like, this cannot happen at all. They got some pushback from the right saying, this is a challenge against freedom of speech because the UC Berkeley is a public school and all these things. So they conceded that they would have it in like a safer place on May 2nd. In the afternoon, a bunch of these different things to try to make it safer, but it ultimately got postponed because police were barricaded everywhere. Antifa threatened to show up. The alt-right came to show up. And with things already heating up in those like past two events and the Milo thing, Berkeley was just like not having it. Although it was fun.
It's not a good thing.
It really isn't. That's why I kind of get back to the whole idea of Trump has won the war on sympathy, because we're at this point where, I mean, I have many problems with Antifa and how the way they work, but like left-wing anarchists have kind of existed for a while now.
Right.
But what's new is this, and what's new and I would argue more relevant because Trump is directly tied to some of this through Steve Bannon, through a lot of his associates, is that you have these people on the right who are treating like other people in public discourse in a way that they would never treat their family members, in a way they would never treat their close friends, just like not even logical. I have people like, people I try to have reasonable conversations with on the right who are saying, why should I care about an immigrant from the Middle East trying to get into the United States? Mm. One saying like, that's been the United States' brand for years, is letting immigrants in, letting them have their chance. You're the descendant of immigrants. I'm sorry, you're not Native American, or like, so you weren't born in the United States. Right. So, your family does not come from the United States. So how are you going to go ahead and, I mean, we've been doing it in all of history. I think it was one of the Kennedys who said, we're a nation of immigrants with short-term memory loss.
Nice.
Good and point. Yeah, it's, immigrants always turn on other newer immigrants in the country. And it sucks, but it's just this like ardent rage. The most recent thing, I'm sorry to be going on like this, but the most recent thing that I'm seeing happen is when people on the left are arguing that someone is inciting violence on the right.
Yeah.
Now people on the right, particularly the libertarian part of the right, are arguing that, well, inciting violence is technically not against the law. And my point is that, okay, if you have to, if your morals are so like corrupt that you have to go all like legalese and go to the letter of the law, sure. But I think inciting violence makes you a dick.
Right.
And I don't think you should try to defend inciting violence. I mean, like, sure you can. And the only person who should try to defend inciting violence is the lawyer of whoever has to defend the asshole. Right. But in society, we're not punishing the same shit anymore. Our standards have become lower. And I think that a lot of what I saw happening with Milo, a lot of what has happened since then, the last aspect of the story, I guess, is that Milo took out a bunch of billboards in downtown Berkeley. They're like really kind of profane and graphic, showing like penises and shit, saying like Cinco de Milo coming soon on the 4th of July. And he's planning on doing some type of thing in the fall semester in the city of Berkeley, where it'll be like a week of alt-right fuckery. And that'll be interesting to watch and cover. But it's just this undercurrent in the country where, because people love Trump so much and love everything he stands for and hate this sort of like social justice warrior culture war that's going on, these people are taken to like this moral extreme where they just like kind of don't care about other people. And that's what worries me a lot.
Yeah, I hear you. I'll start to think about it in those terms as well. These flare-ups into violence and small clashes, I wonder if that's just a Berkeley thing. Ann Coulter's coming to LA, right, at the end of this month to Politicon to debate Anna Kasparian, if I understand correctly. Do you expect that there would be some clashes and confrontations here, or people in LA are just not into it, they don't care?
I mean, that depends on like Politicon security and other aspects like that. I mean, it's not a perfect comparison, but I see where you're coming from. Berkeley is a very like notably kind of like left, not even just Berkeley, but it's the Bay Area in general. It's a notably far left kind of part of the country. That's where you got like the Black Panthers coming from. That's where you get a lot of the most like progressive ideology that isn't even like acceptable by other progressives. You get in the Bay Area.
Right.
And so that's one factor that's a little different. But you're seeing like leading up to the Milo event, there were incidents of violence in Washington State and in Florida. And so the undercurrent behind all this is the debate about political correctness on college campuses. That's happening everywhere. And that's not just happening in college campuses, that's happening in our media, in our public discourse, in the way like not just our news media, but everything else is happening. And so all these things are percolating in society. And I think the Bay Area, I just happen to be lucky or unlucky to be in the epicenter of that. But to answer your question, in a place like LA, yeah, I can see people protesting Ann Coulter because there are people on the further left than me who say that Ann Coulter doesn't even have a right to speak based on all the things she says, especially at a place at Politicon, which is a private event. And so, yeah, there are going to be people who try to shut that down, as I think there are probably often people on the right who try to like shut Cenk and Anna down for different things. It's just
gotten that bad though.
Thankfully, but like the way we think about discourse now is becoming more polarized to where if you don't believe in exactly what I say, I don't believe in your right to like almost even exist. That's coming definitely from the right and from some reaches of the far left as well.
Yeah, well, one reason why the Ann Coulter thing in Politicon may not amount to much is that it's not that big of an event, sadly. I wish this were different, but they don't get that much publicity.
Yeah,
that's plus what we're trying to change.
But plus you have to pay to get into that.
Yeah, plus it's a political convention where you're supposed to have this.
And Politicon, at least my knowledge, isn't like super partisan. Like they try to invite, and they do a good job of inviting people from the left, people from the right.
Yes, I believe so. All right, so we're going to wrap up with this just small obit because that's what I do, and then that'll be it. So, Herma Hill Kay was the first female dean of the University of California at Berkeley Law School. She was the second female professor of law at Berkeley, where she started in 1960. She became the dean in 1992. When California ruled that affirmative action was illegal or against the state constitution, and minority enrollment began to plummet. No, well, minority enrollment did plummet at University of California at Berkeley Law School. She initiated a whole bunch of outreach programs to try to bring more minorities back in. So she's just a good, solid professor of law who became the dean of Berkeley Law School. Not a big deal, like many of the obits that I cover. That's why we cover them here, and they're not front page news. But I found it interesting. She was born to a preacher in South Carolina, a Methodist preacher who was just like, this guy is like out of a William Faulkner novel. He just traveled around all over the Southeast being a preacher. So she didn't have any one home to be, they constantly were moving. It's a crazy lifestyle, totally foreign to me, that they would just move, I guess, for wherever, whatever church would give him a role or a preaching position for however many months or a couple of years that it took. She only stabilized herself by going to college and then eventually law school and getting a real job here in California. But that's Herma Hill K passing away at 82, a trailblazer at University of California, Berkeley Law School. And that's it. You stole the show today, Dan. That was good stuff on the immigration raids and on Berkeley. So thank you.
No worries.
And you're around all summer, so we may do this again.
Would be fun.
All right. And thanks, as always, for being TYT members. Have a good weekend.
Stay strong, or whatever you say.